For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time once again for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. Well, Oklahoma is even more broke than we originally thought. It turns out the Office of Management and Enterprise Services has taken all of the $240 million in the state's Constitutional Reserve, also known as the Rainy Day Fund. The money from what is basically the state's savings account has gone to deal with Oklahoma cash flow, but is expected to be paid back by the OMES. Neva, your thoughts on this?
Well, first of all, I think Senate Appropriations Chairwoman Kim David basically said what is true. This is nothing new. I mean, whether we like it or not, the state formerly had what they called a special fund for cash flow management. They emptied that when they had the budget problems last year. And so what we really have with OMES is a situation where they're using these funds to pay bills, knowing that the funds from these different agencies and the taxes and other things being collected will replenish the funds. So what it really points to systemically is the fact that we've got a very antiquated system that needs to be fixed, and this just exacerbates the problem when we get to the finger pointing and name calling.
Ryan.
You know, this is, you know, really symptomatic of a structural budget deficit. I mean, this is where we're at. And we had an operational account where money could be taken to use for cash flow issues in the past. We depleted that last year to make up for budget shortfalls or revenue shortfalls. So that's empty. And now we're at the point where OMES is having to borrow against the rainy day fund. And they're saying, well, the money's going to be back there. The appropriations chair in the Senate says, well, this is normal. But it's really not normal, because one of the reasons that we're in this position to begin with is our revenue projections were off. And that led to this to begin with. So to say that revenue projections tell us that we're going to be able to replenish the rainy day fund, you know, we can say that and we can cross our fingers and hope that that's the case, but there's really no guarantee.
But we also have to be realistic about the fact that we don't have a government that just puts a pool of money into an account and spends off of it to pay the bills all through the year on those things that are appropriated. I mean, money comes in. It comes in at different times, just like tax season and other times where there is a much higher spike in terms of the revenue coming into the state coffers. So there is this struggle. I mean, the bottom line to that struggle, though, is managing what you really intend to spend versus what you think will come in, which what we continue to see year after year is it's less than what is anticipated. Right. So I think that's where the realism has to get factored into this equation more than it has been in the past.
And we all take money out of our savings accounts. Sometimes right. It's a bad month. We've got to
it's a bridge.
It's when there's just no money coming in. That's when you really notice the money starting to slip out of your savings account. This is what was really happening. It's normal to be using this money. But the fact that we are so broke that now we're noticing that the money is being taken out of savings accounts.
And the savings accounts, and so I wouldn't think, you know, with the state, I'd say that there are multiple savings accounts, right? You've got the rainy day fund, which is your OMG account. It's the, you know, something's really bad happened and this is where we're going. But then within agencies and within the state itself in general, there are these cash flow operational accounts that, you know, the reserves that agencies that are able to use whenever the revenue doesn't come in the way it's supposed to, or there are special needs that arise. Well, those have been depleted over the last several years. I mean, we've taken the couch cushions and we've pulled
they've
them off the couch. We've shaken all the
rated.
Change out.
They've been rated. They've been rated by the legislature to try to balance a budget at the end of the process. And that is where we have this problem that now is a huge problem. I mean, before they could play on the edge and somehow it worked out okay. Now we're in a place where they really are going to have to address it much more seriously, I think, this year with the budget.
Yeah.
So the shortfall in the rainy day fund came up because of a joint committee meeting to give a $34 million supplemental to the Department of Human Services. $30 million would come from the unclaimed property fund, with $4 million from the Constitutional Reserve. Now, Ryan, the supplemental passed unanimously out of the House on Wednesday, but not before heated accusations and insults by representatives.
Well, you know, and I think that what we're seeing, the tone and the anger and the frustration and the desperation that we're seeing in the legislature right now is reflecting the fact that, you know, the rhetoric that we've had around the budget for years and years about, you know, the sky is falling. And we've talked a little about kind of this delayed pain. Well, the pain is coming home to roost. I mean, we're at a point right now where the most vulnerable Oklahomans, the disabled, the young, and the elderly, are really beginning to face catastrophic consequences in the event that we don't have a supplemental passed for DHS. You know, you had a 10-month budget essentially passed during the last fiscal year. So it was, you know, we passed 10 months and we said, well, we'll come back and we'll fix the other 2 months. Now it's time to do that. And we're at a point where they're taking money out of the rainy day fund to make sure that they've got the operational cash flow to do it. If they don't do this, thousands of Oklahomans that are able to stay at home right now at a cost much less to the state to, you know, have bathing services, food, nutritional services, anything other than going into long-term institutionalized care or a nursing home, which is much more expensive for the individual and the state, to stave that off, we're at this point right now. These are scary times if you're a vulnerable Oklahoman. These services that I think that for a long time we've just taken for granted that they're going to be there are now at an end date. And we saw that with this with the supplemental. And if it doesn't pass, that end date is nigh.
Neva.
Well, I mean, Ryan is right. I mean, the real crux of this issue in particular with DHS on the supplemental is the fact that they did pass a 10-month, not a 12-month budget. So they knew going into this session that they were going to have to remedy that they were going to have $30 million they were going to need to come up with to deal with this particular deficit in the budget. So I think it again points to the fact that if you're going to deal with the budget in this manner, you're going to continue to have this kind of contentious interplay as you come in session after session and have to deal with things that are already on the table and already in motion, as opposed to things that you're looking at for the future. So, and Ryan's right. I mean, we're back to the bottom line issue. What are we going to fund and what are we not going to fund? And if we want to fund these particular issues in DHS or any other major agencies that are going to get the lion's share of the budget appropriations, then we have to figure out how to make those numbers work at the end. And I think that's where there's been this mindset in the legislature that somehow we'll just kind of, you know, continue to spin the plates and at the end of the process, it'll magically all be okay. And that's not where we are right now today.
And at what point do we stop what Gary Jones calls creative accounting and actually start doing these things? You know, I guess the Democrats were called out by the Republicans for grandstanding, but someone's got to stand up and say, you can't do this anymore.
Well, the Republicans are in control. They don't want anyone to point the finger at them and say, you've run the state into the ground right now. The Democrats are doing what they need to do to try to raise this issue. And let's really look at where we're at right now. I think we can talk about hyperbole, but I think we're beyond the point of where hyperbole is hyperbole. It's the facts. And, the Democrats on the Senate floor are calling this out for what it is. You know, kudos to them, because what we're doing each year, think about this. We passed a 10-month budget as a way so that legislators could walk into the last election cycle with a budget that looked better than it actually was. And so they passed this 10-month cycle on. You know, we're to the point where we've already cash flow reserves, so we're at zero, and we're now borrowing against the rainy day fund and crossing our fingers that the money's going to be there. We're making each subsequent legislative session more difficult for the incoming legislators to deal with. And just at the same time we're doing that, because of term limits, we're electing more and more freshman lawmakers that don't know a single thing about the appropriations process. That's not an insult to them. It takes a long time to get up to speed on that. So we're taking these rookies and we're increasing this to expert mode, and then it's kind of coming apart at the seams. And so at some point, you know, if you look, you know, Preston Dorflinger, whenever he made mention of the fact that we were going to be borrowing against the rainy day fund, he said, you know, the former finance secretary, Scott Meacham, looked younger today because he's not doing this. And that joke, you know, Dale Denwalt in The Oklahoman said that joke kind of like threw him off the actual notice that they were borrowing against the rainy day fund. But it gave me some hope that, you know, Preston Dorflinger's at least probably talking to or looking at the actions of folks like Scott Meacham, and these, you know, these kind of the grown-ups in the room are saying, you know, what can we do to fix this? And it's going to be incumbent upon these lawmakers, especially the rookie lawmakers, to put politics aside and say, you know, what are the fixes here, and we've got to do them fast.
And even the other problem, of course, with term limits is that everybody who basically put us in the situation in the first place, they're no longer there.
Right.
So it's no one really to blame because they've already gone on.
Well, and I think that's the issue. Let's get past the blame game. And Ryan is right. At some point, you have to get a working consensus in both the House and the Senate. And ideally, you would think that there would be some opportunity, that there would be some bipartisan nature to that. We're seeing exactly in Oklahoma what we see in Washington, D.C. I mean, and this name-calling, finger-pointing, back and forth, who's to blame, serves no good purpose for the people in terms of realistically addressing the budget issues. And hopefully, I mean, although I'm not highly optimistic that we're going to get past this impasse, but at least if we continue to talk about it, maybe we'll see some of these folks, not necessarily maybe top leadership, but maybe some of these folks that are, you know, are the rookies, the people coming in who say, I'm going to be here hopefully for a while, and these are things that we need to really start working on now to try to fix or at least have a dialogue so that when we get in a place where maybe we're in a better, maybe a better position 2 or 3 years down the road, we can address these things more favorably and actually get some better setup for the future.
And very quickly, Randy Kriebel's article in the Tulsa World said it might be a preview of the next 8 weeks.
Yeah.
Is this a preview of the next 8 weeks?
Absolutely.
I think
it's probably just going to get...
And it's normal. Let's face it. Once we get to midway point, I mean, this is not... I mean, we shouldn't be surprised that we are where we are. We just need to follow it and see if we see signs of some improvement in terms of what they do in terms of addressing it. And it may be... Maybe in ways that certain groups and segments don't like, but nevertheless, let's come up with if from a legislative perspective, I think they need to come up with a plan. Now we're seeing some of these folks say we have plans on some issues, so we'll see how they roll those out and whether they really materialize.
When I came into the legislature, some of the best advice I had came from former Lieutenant Governor Jerry Askin. She told me, she said, become an expert in something. You know, don't come up here and be a generalist. Find something that you're really passionate about and know more about it than anybody else. And what I would suggest to all of these freshman lawmakers is they need to become experts in the budget. Each and every one of them, what they need to be focusing on and on, you know, anything else that they care about right now is going to have to come back to that budget. And then the second thing is that when we talk about grown-ups in the room, the governor's got the veto pen, and she needs to be putting some pressure on the legislative leadership to give her a responsible budget. You know, if they went ahead and they passed, you know, House Bill 1482, the criminal justice rollback bill, if they leave her criminal justice task force bills off the table, you know, that sets up a 10-year budget deficit. And so there are a lot of things that are at play in the legislature that have an impact, long-term impact on the budget. The governor, I encourage her to step up to the plate and say, I'm going to use my veto pen if you guys aren't responsible out there and you're in the Senate and the House.
Which she has done in the years past.
Right.
Last week during his press availability, the House Speaker told reporters he has a plan to pay for teacher raises. Charles McCall says he has been talking to the governor and Senate leadership about the plan to finance the House bill, which increases teachers' salaries $6,000 over the next 3 years. Neva, he says the plan is ongoing, sustainable, won't raise taxes or take money from another agency. Is this possible?
Well, he obviously, I think, in saying that, has something that he's willing to articulate, he's willing to put on paper, and somewhere they've come up with this $312 million that it's going to take, or at least the initial part of that, to have the 1-2-3 plan, they call it, the $1,000 the first year, $2,000 the second year, $3,000 the third year. But, you know, let's face it, the Senate adopted a 4% increase plan with some acceleration for another 4% the second year. So we've got competing plans, as is not unusual between the House and the Senate. And I think what we are seeing is that both bodies appear to be very intent, even with the backdrop of this terrible budget situation, to try to do something where a teacher pay raise is concerned. And we'll see whether they can really get that done. It appears that they're at least still talking about it seriously enough that I would expect that something will happen. It may not be anything like what teachers hope for or what people think is really a serious proposal. It remains to be seen.
Ryan McCall says the plan is written down, but didn't want to go into specifics about how it works.
Yeah, I think it's on his desk next to the "Eat All You Want and Lose Weight Too" plan. You know, I'd like to see the actual plan here. I mean, what's the purpose in hiding it at this point? And, you know, the legislative session is well underway. We all know that we have a bleak revenue picture for the state of Oklahoma. If you've got a plan out there that does that, it's probably going to touch on some of the other revenue issues and expenditure issues for the state of Oklahoma. We need to know that. It's good to know it now for the next 8 weeks rather than, you know, try to, you know, put all those puzzle pieces together in the last 2 weeks. And we talk about all the different puzzle pieces, you know, Speaker McCaul. Well, let me go back to that. I think that one encouraging sign of all of this is the fact that what we're beginning to see is, you know, we've reached critical mass in terms that Republicans and Democrats now feel a need to satisfy the education lobby. And, you know, so that's, they've really, their mobilization and their political weight is being felt across the state and in the legislature. Now, they're at a point where the legislature can't do a whole lot about it because they don't have any money, but everybody's trying, right? And so I think that that speaks favorably about the education lobby. And then, you know, finally, the other piece is, you know, Speaker McCaul, here's a guy who has put the governor's task force bills, criminal justice task force bills, in Representative Scott Biggs's committee in the House. You know, here's Representative Biggs, who's hostile to these pieces of legislation and hostile to criminal justice reform. If Speaker McCaul wants to see a responsible budget, he can't put these bills in this committee and then create a 10-year budget deficit on criminal justice issues and then say he's going to pay for a teacher pay raise. And they all have to work together here. And, you know, what? So I'm seeing mixed messages out of the Speaker's office about how serious he is about solving our state's revenue problem.
Yeah, and you've mentioned the Senate bills got the 4% raises, but to pay for the 4% raises, they've asked for the motor vehicle taxes to be increased, but the motor vehicle taxes have to be increased in the House.
Right.
So there's this back and forth. Is there going to be?
Well, and it's the back and forth that is the negotiating process that is where we're at. I mean, a lot of these moving pieces begin to be talked about, massaged, worked with through the early part of the legislative process. I mean, and in a lot of meetings and a lot of discussions. So it takes a long time to kind of tee up the final, you know, final fight in terms of the two or three big issues that both sides are really going to dig in, say they're intractable on, and then somehow have to get in the room and fight it out and negotiate and come up with something that hopefully they can all live with and the governor would sign. So it's not a unique process. It's a somewhat ugly process. I think people, when they see it up close, begin to see, you know, and wonder, it's a miracle how we ever get anything out of this process. But it is the give and take of legislation and compromise and the battling back and forth. So I guess I'm at a place where it's always at this time in the legislative session that you begin to really focus on the budget and you really begin to pay attention to who the real significant players are who can make things happen.
Speaker McCaul had talked about, they'd asked some questions about the Democratic budget, that the Democrats have put together a budget and put it out, and he said that he's still not received it. I guess the Democrats did have a press conference, and I don't know whether he has or not, but if they haven't turned in a budget, given him the budget that they basically went to a press conference about, do you think that's the mistake by the Democrats?
Well, I mean, they should deliver it to the Speaker. You know, I'd like to think that that's happened. I mean, you know, if the Speaker wants to see it, I'm sure he could get a copy of it. And I bet it's on their website or something like that. But nevertheless, they should deliver him a copy. The budget that the Democrats have proposed, though, is you know, more than likely dead on arrival with the Speaker's office, because he doesn't want to put his members in a position of having to vote up or down on any sort of a tax increase unless he can absolutely, it's unavoidable. And well, so, I mean, we saw that with cigarette taxes, we saw it with, you know, the fuel tax, and now we're seeing it with, you know, they're certainly not going to entertain any type of major revenue raising measure like an income tax increase or you know, some sort of increase in taxes on gross production.
And here's the wild card, I think, in the mix. Do you find a group of Republicans who are willing to cross the aisle and get, you know, either all or a majority of the Democrats and be able to forge enough votes in the House that they could actually start the process on one of these issues, whether it's a cigarette tax, whether it's some other tax, whatever it happens to be? Is there a way to cobble that together? There's a lot of discussion, a lot of speculation, a long way from seeing anything a reality, but that would be the real change in the process if we saw something like that occur this session. And, you know, it'll be fascinating to see if that's a possibility.
Finally, the state Supreme Court strikes the rewritten language in a medical marijuana state question put forth by former Attorney General Scott Pruitt. This allows what will be State Question 788 to move forward with the original title put forth by initiative petition organizers. Ryan, your thoughts on this?
You know, the ACLU, we represented Oklahomans for Health, the folks that ran this historic signature gathering effort. And I say historic because they gathered more than 67,000 signatures and spent virtually nothing compared to what these signature gathering campaigns usually cost. And most of the time, whenever folks have come to us or we've worked with other organizations that have been in signature gathering campaigns to get something on the ballot, the conventional wisdom is if you don't have $1 million, don't even try, because getting these signatures within the 90-day time frame is near impossible. Mm-hmm. But they did it. And then the Attorney General rewrote it in a way that made their medical marijuana petition seem as if it were creating a recreational marijuana system in the state of Oklahoma. Now, I'd love to see a recreational marijuana system in the state of Oklahoma where we have responsible adult use and it's taxed and the revenue goes back to the state. But that's not what the petitioners of this ballot measure were trying to do. They wanted to create a medical marijuana system for patients to have to be able to make decisions with their doctors about what is the best and appropriate medicine for them. The court did something pretty extraordinary here. Normally, in the past, what we've seen them do is they'll write their own ballot measure. They'll take a little from, mm-hmm. from one, from the AG, some from the original language, and they'll come up with something. Here, they dismissed the Attorney General's rewrite entirely and went right back to what the petitioners put in front of the people. I think that that honors the voice of the people that signed that petition, and I think that it's going to give the folks of Oklahoma a real policy decision, probably in November of 2018, for their consideration.
Neva?
Well, I think it will be interesting whether it is November of 2018 or whether the governor decides to try to move that into either a special election or sometime earlier. And there's a lot of arguments. I mean, yeah. When you get this type of state question on the ballot, I mean, who that favors, who wants to see it on the ballot when they're on the ballot, all of those dynamics. So I think that'll be kind of the next thing that's in play in terms of not that there will be an election, but when that election occurs. And mm-hmm. and you're right, Ryan. I mean, the Supreme Court, it was a 7-1 decision. So it was a very yeah. strong statement by the Supreme Court on this matter. And the fact that they did go back to the original language that that the architects of this particular state question put together.
Do you think that the governor might call a special election if she thinks that this might bring out more progressives to vote for it? I mean, that could conceivably hurt whoever's.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, after visiting with some election experts in the state, you know, the most plausible election for this to be on, you know, based upon the wording of the law that deals with initiatives and referendums and when they go on the ballot, is probably the general election in 2018. You know, there is an opportunity to call a special election, but of course, if you call a special election in which there's not ballots being cast in every precinct, you're paying for precincts to be open for a particular vote. The state of Oklahoma is broke right now, as we talked about earlier in the program, yeah, yeah. So spending money that we don't have really doesn't seem like a great option. You know, it could potentially be on that primary ballot next summer. You know, there are a lot of different places that it could be, but the one election that we know that there's going to be a ballot cast in every precinct in the state mm-hmm. of Oklahoma is that November of 2018 ballot. So I'm not sure really which is at this moment. I can't tell you as somebody who's in favor of this which ballot it should be on, but I think that the people of Oklahoma should rest easy in knowing that at least by November of 2018, we'll have a chance to vote on this.
And while I say the progressives might come out to vote for it, there are some conservatives who have supported, because the medical use of marijuana, I know that using marijuana, but there have been proven uses for medical marijuana, and I know there's some conservatives who back that as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see when it's on the ballot what the large majority of Oklahomans really feel about this issue.
It'll be very interesting. And Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.